Hi, I'm Tom Colicchio, and this is Citizen Chef. On this podcast, we're looking at policy and shifts in society through the food system. This season, we're going over the basics of the food system and how food policy affects our daily lives. So far, we've talked to experts on immigration, slavery on the high seas, and food assistance programs. In this episode, we're talking about an almost 150-year-old idea, and that's reparations. I'm Italian-American. My grandfather came here in 1903 when he was 3 years old. My great-grandfather brought him over, and my great-grandfather went back and forth and made a few trips while he was actually building a house back in Velata, Italy, where my family is from, my father's family is from. And now I think if my ancestors were forced to come to this country and enslaved, and when they were freed, they were promised 40 acres of fertile soil somewhere. And I knew that going back in my life, in my family, we would have been able to build some sort of wealth based on these 40 acres. If it stayed in my family for a couple generations, this would have been how my family built wealth. And if that were the case and it were stripped away from them, after 400 years of slavery, Jim Crow laws and redlining and other forms of discrimination, you better believe I would take this personally, and you better believe this is something that my family would live with. And this is something that my family would think that possibly we should get something from the government. When we talk about reparations, I think too often people think it's just a payout, but what it really is repairing a relationship. And that's the relationship between African-Americans who were cheated out of land that was promised to them. How do you repair that relationship? How do you, mend those wounds? That's what we're talking about here. How do you repair a relationship? How do you make things right after years, centuries of getting them wrong? And what does a true apology look like? So why are we talking reparations on our food podcast? This for a lot of reasons, and I think we have a confluence of three different things happening. Obviously, with the death of George Floyd and the protests that we're seeing and the Black Lives Matter movement really sort of being front and center in our news cycle, and then, in my opinion, a part of where we're going to end up with the movement is looking at reparations. So reparations becoming also prevalent in our news cycle. And I believe in the 2020 election, it's going to play a pretty important role as well. However, because the effects of racist systems can be found in every crevice of American life, we have to find where reparations are required in our corner of the world. Well, my corner of the world is food. So today, we'll be talking about what chefs and the food industry owe Black Americans. And because we are talking about land, and because we're mostly talking about farmland, and because our podcast has to do with food and food sovereignty, well, this kind of runs headlong into our conversations around food and around current topics. We're going to jump right in here. I had a conversation with chef and historian Michael Twitty, and here we go. We had planned on doing an episode on reparations going back when we first started conceiving the podcast, and obviously it takes a very different meaning right now, I imagine, and that's why I say I'm nervous having this conversation is because so often white people like me get it wrong. I'm not asking from a position of, hey, I need help. Help me as a white person understand this. But there's so much we don't understand. And when reading through your book and reading through your blogs, I can't walk a mile in your shoes. I can't walk in your steps because there's too much history there. There's too much pain there. But I can walk alongside you and say, hey, I'm here to do whatever the hell I can to make things better and to be an ally. But man, it's really fraught. But listen, let's just jump in. Because why the hell not? So I do want to start by asking a question here, and it's actually a couple lines from your book. And it says, I think it's in the intro, it says, I began to wonder if I ever really would be able to locate myself in human experience. What good is it to learn the flow of human history and to speak of the dead if their stories don't speak to you? What if food history and facts, figures, and flashpoints? What good is your own position as a culinary historian if you can't find yourself in the narrative of your food story and if you don't know who you are? So, Michael, in your journey, who did you find out who are you? What is your role here? What is as a historian, as a chef, as a cook, as a someone who writes about food in a way where you cannot help but want to cook with you, alongside you, taste the food that you're cooking, and understand your experience. So who are you?
You know, there was the Apu, may he rest in peace and power. Once said on The Simpsons in response to Homer, Apu, how are you? He says, I haven't slept. I was kept up by the howls of my ancestors. That's my life. But it's also the new connection with other people. I think I joked with you when we met that, you know, I'm like 1% Italian. And I figured out how that was. One of my family's white folks was part Italian and part English. And that kind of like global feeling that you get once you do the whole DNA thing and discover those things in your family tree, it's more than just a percentage on a paper. You know, that and understanding that I am as an African American, I am valid and affirmed as I am. I think that I'm very proud to be of African descent, and I'm uplifted by the trips that I've made to West Africa. At this point, I've made 7 journeys in 8 countries. But I guess the point is that I didn't realize that we get talked about really. You know, every time something happens with us, someone has some smart shit to say. Excuse my French. Somebody has something nasty to say. It's a qualifier. And I'm like, you know what? No, we're an exceptional people. And we're a very proud people among the many Black peoples of the Black Atlantic. And I guess, you know, when I started out, the reason why I said that quote in the book was because I was in a field that was mostly white women of some privilege, wealth, and capital. One of the few males. Definitely, I every time I walk in the room, I'm the raisin in the kugel. You know, I'm just not in the majority. And then, you know, they would write about these people in history in a sort of titillating, fun way and never really place themselves. And I said, that must be liberating to be able to write about something and cook something and live something and not wonder, why am I here? Why am I in this space doing what I'm doing? And then, of course, there was this constant theme of the Black cook and the Black cook during slavery. I've always been fascinated by that. My ancestors from that time period are really calling me, and my African ancestors are really calling to me. Because I guess I felt like, no, I didn't feel like, I knew they were being forgotten. Nameless, you know, slapped on boxes, given these monikers, and then they were going to fade away. And then, you know, in a space between white guilt and Black trauma, you know, and that's just what it is. So I decided I'm going to document this stuff. I'm going to go through it. At first, it was like paper plates and plastic spoons and stuff from the grocery store. And then it was like, nah, you can't be rolling like that. You really got to do the historical interpreter thing. And then a couple years ago, I was just like, okay, you can't just talk about the food in a sort of a, like everybody else, what you're talking about. You have to do it. You have to translate what the folk culture into a language that culinary people can understand so that they can really grasp what you're trying to pass on. Otherwise, they're not going to get it. You know, they can perceive it. You know what I'm saying? They can perceive it, but it's not the same language.
Yeah, everybody wants to tell their stories through food, and they have to communicate, and because that's the story that people want to hear. They don't want to know about a pretty plate of food. They want to know the history behind it. They want to understand why you're doing what you do, why you're cooking what you're cooking, and so yeah, I'm trying to understand the food that you grew up cooking, besides your grandmother and your mother. And then taking a deeper dive into why those. I mean, the story in your book of homecoming, I thought that was just this idea of abundance and this food that you're going to enjoy, and it's your food, and it's food that you dream of, and it's food that means so much, and just the idea where you're going there and you're with your people and you're having the time of your life, and it's all about food. And, you know, I tell those stories when I talk about growing up Italian,
right,
and how I realized at a certain point that it's not necessarily what's on the plate, but it brings people together.
Right.
And then once you're together, then you have those discussions, and whether you're talking politics or whether you're gossip, you know, this family gossip that, you know,
right,
going back and forth. And so, you know, this is what it does. And so, you know, having that is, you know, it is part of history. It is part of who you are. So what made you start sort of taking that deeper dive to go to Africa, to really sort of finding, I always say, you know, when I went to Europe to learn how to, you know, cook either French food or Italian food, what I learned there was why, not so much what, but why, yeah, why you cook, why certain things are what they are. What did you find on those trips?
I guess my word would be who.
Who? Ah, I like it.
You know, who, because like, so yeah, you get there and you see the staples and you go, I knew this was coming, but it's nice to know with my own two eyes and my mouth and my hands, it's all there. But what I didn't know was how many things had to be passed down in almost like in secret.
Mm-hmm.
The most momentous moment for me was tasting on my hand. Okay. So like, I'm a dude. So there, I'm not the cook. Women are right. The cooks. Unless you barbecue meat, roast meat. It's all the woman thing. So I'm going in, and these women are looking at me like weird, like, why is he even in our space? And so I took the spoon, then I took the sauce or whatever, and I put it on my hand, and I licked it off, and they all sort of getting very agitated and very excited, and like, hey, and they sort of patting me on the back and hugging me and kissing me on the cheek. And I'm like, what did I do? All I did was taste the food. Then I started coming out of my mouth and said, the way my grandmother and mother taught me. And then I realized they were excited because they realized that I had been taught the proper way generation to generation to generation.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, you know, there's like in Africa, you look your hand and look at the back of your hand. And that was, they were like, okay, he's not a black European from America. That's how they think of us until proven otherwise. And then it was like, oh my God. Yeah, he's one of us. He's one of us. He's one of us. He knows what's up. And that's then. So the answer is, who are they and who am I? Who am I? And this, you know, it's not a technique culture of food. It's more like the circumstances in which you eat the food, the season you eat the food, the spiritual occasion, the feeling around the food is more important than the process of making it.
Got it.
So that energy that you put into it, that soul that you put into it, is a key ingredient. The area, you know, someone who is a peaceable person doesn't grow your peppers in Africa. Someone who is like from birth aligned with, you know, the deities that control war and blood and anger, that's the one who should grow the peppers. You know, it's like everything is congenital. Everything is, you know, and also from heaven. And so there's that. And it's just like, there's the rhythm and the kinesthetics. Like food is, you know, your body goes into it. So we joke around and say in Southern talk, someone put their foot in it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that shit's literal in Africa, because when you make the locust bean paste, they're like, it's like in Italy, you know, the stomping of the grapes.
So I stopped
looking for techniques, and I started listening for the sound of it, the feeling in the body, the feeling in the room, and that really got to me. It made me understand why I didn't always attach the color of the food and the color of the ingredients, and just all of that mattered so much more than the process.
Mm-hmm.
Although that's definitely there. It's very deep, and it's there, and there's things you got to know. But I guess for me, another part for me was just like, I was seeing things in reality that I had read about in books from 200 to 300 years ago.
Hmm. Okay.
And the fact that people preferred to eat food cooked over the wood fire with the three rocks, there's no such thing as let's, you know, modernize this food. It's almost like you have to eat the food that was eaten at the time our ancestors left the continent.
Got it. So how did that change you as a cook?
I tell people all the time that to be Black American, be African American and go to Africa is to suddenly drop all the awkwardness that you felt about being Black in America. Cause it's you, the loudness, the spiciness, the greasiness, the fat frying in the air. I mean, all that stuff, it's queerness. Okay. I'm a queer person because I'm gay, but I'm also a queer person because in relationship to normative whiteness, mm-hmm. being Black is queer in America. Like being Italian was queer. And sometimes still is queer in America, you know? And I want to specify that for everybody. Queer in this sense means not normative in relationship to power.
Right.
So when you grow up here, Black, you feel sometimes you're made to feel out of your skin. It doesn't matter how much America appropriates Blackness or uses Blackness, Black bodies, Black labor, Black mm-hmm. for entertainment, for whatever, you're still an outsider. You're still an other. And so you're made to feel like you never quite fit in. But over there, 95% of the time, especially with the food culture, you feel as a Black American that you don't feel awkward anymore. You feel natural.
Yeah, I can hear the assholes already saying, "We'll go back." I can hear it.
Yes, I got an answer for them. Most of them that say that, they already part Negro. They've already incorporated Blackness, Africanness, and coloredness, and all of our stuff into their life already. So they can go back with me. You know, that was Dick Gregory said that. He said, "You ever met a drunk white supremacist?" And they said, "I have." He said, "Go back to Africa and take me with you." So there you go.
Yeah. So you come back and you decide that the best place to apply your craft is on plantations.
Yeah.
Take me through that process.
Okay. So I had already been doing that kind of work, but the problem was, I never forget when I first started, someone who I will not name said to me at a museum, a food person said to me, "Well, I don't know anything about Africa." And I said, "We're in the South. You are right down the road from where slave ships actually came into North America. How could you not know this?" And I just took a deep breath and said, "Stop, don't get mad, just do the work. Just do the damn work." And so I started with documenting every single ingredient that would have been used on any plantation anywhere in North America, North American mainland, and documenting where it came from. I did a whole spreadsheet. Then I was like, okay, I got to get the clothes and I got to get the utensils, learn how to use them, learn how to take care of them. All of that. Then it was about the feeling. What does it mean? And I'm actually, Tom, glad I've had negative experiences that taught me, put me in the right mindset of just like, this is not easy, this is not cute, this is not whatever. Like one time in the book, I talk about how like I was at Stratford Hall Plantation, which was the home plantation of the Lees in Virginia. And it was dark and there was a big crowd for Plantation Christmas. So they had me in there cooking and talking about the food, and it was this huge pot and it was really heavy. I mean, those pots get to like 60, 70 pounds. And it was full of water. Water was hot and the fire was hot and it was dark. And I spilled some of the water and people laughed at me. And I got immediately angry. And then I was like, y'all realize that this was back in the day. I could have gotten severely punished for even having a human accident, a mistake. But then for them, it was laughing at me because, oh, this Black guy thinks he knows everything and he's stumbling in the kitchen. Well, you try to be on a brick floor for 12 hours, you know, with flat feet cooking. And then, you know, but even more than that, people come to the kitchen, they'd be like, "Oh, I know what it's like to be a slave. I'm an evangelical Christian in America." Oh God.
Stop.
You know,
yeah.
What?
I think you also point out in the book that not only were people punished, but people were put in ovens for doing this.
Yes, in the Caribbean.
For making mistakes.
In Martinique, a cook was actually put in the bake oven, thrown in the bake oven and murdered because he burned a cake. And the mistress of the plantation sat through dinner smiling and laughing and getting drunk and then showed her guests the skeleton. And I mean, this wasn't, of course, this wasn't an everyday occurrence, but the cruelty was the point.
Right.
And it was constant. But to go from there to Africa was always my dream, but because I wanted people to understand something. I guess my point, is not that everything was African. But, you know, Hermann Keisling said something very important, 1922, almost 100 years ago. He says, everything that is born Africa remains African in spirit. And to get to the other side of the ocean, you got to understand, yes, there were European and Native American, other elements of the cooking, but the hands of the black cook were the catalyst. The mind of the black cook was the catalyst. But people don't even think Africa has a mind. There's an intellect, just like there is in Italian cooking and French cooking. And I just wanted to be able to be that translator through historical documents, through lived experience, through people's memories, that art and philosophy came to America through food, not just the taste.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. Hey, this is Citizen Chef, and I'm Tom Colicchio. Let's pick up where we left off in my conversation with chef and author Michael Twitty. We're talking about how the question of reparations in America intersect with policy and cultural foodways, especially in the South. What is the debt, and how do we pay it back? Just from a food standpoint and from a land standpoint, what do reparations look like? You know, I know H.R. 40 is just set up to study it. If you were put on that panel to study reparations through a food lens, what does that look like to you?
Oh, first of all, we have to correct the violence of hunger, the violence of wasted food. We have to correct the violence of food inequality. We have to correct the violence of not having land.
Why do you refer to it as violence? I understand, but just for the listener, why do you refer to it as violence?
Because these are ways that keep people, it's a passive aggressive form of war. I mean, you know, everybody knows about the Black Panthers. Oh, the scary Black Panthers. Those scary Black Panthers?
Yeah, they were scary because they were giving out food.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they're, you know, I don't know if you know about the fake coloring books.
No, I don't.
The fake coloring books that the CIA put out. This is, by the way, y'all, this is not me looking at something crazy. These are actual things that exist. Fake coloring books. They said, look at these coloring books these black kids are getting with the Black Panthers, and they emphasized the food program. That was one of the things that J. Edgar Hoover and his cronies thought was one of the worst things the Black Panthers did. Feed hungry people and feed kids.
Right, before they realized kids were going to school without getting a meal, and that's why they started doing it. And that's dangerous for some reason.
Yes, it's dangerous because the hand that feeds you. You don't bite the hand that feeds you. We also know now, you and I both know, that a child that is nourished can think better, can go to school and achieve an education better, can doesn't have to worry about, their mind isn't off worrying about where the next meal is going to come from or where they're going to live tomorrow. And so it's that kind of thing, that kind of power. I mean, it's like this. And when I was 2012, when I did the Southern Discomfort Tour, I went to the River Road African American Museum. And there's this plaque on the wall from 1912 celebrating this community of black Creole farmers that took the sharecroppers in the area and said, look, y'all don't have to go into debt. Go on eating, you know, the plantation owner's food and buying rations from him. You can get good quality food from our fields without shame. Come and get it. And we'll all farm the land together. And all I could think was, they answered the question of how to tackle a food desert in 1912 without Black Twitter, without Facebook, without Instagram, without Snapchat. And they did it in the face of the Klan, the Knights of the White Camellia, and errant law enforcement. and the plantation aristocracy, which still existed. So what are we doing wrong? Was a question I asked myself. Another element of reparations in this area is education. Why is it, where is the culinary school that has a two-semester class, not one, a two-semester class on African foods of the world, on the continent and in the diaspora? Because we know, you and I both know, every time they learn about Brazilian food, Southern food, Caribbean food, they're learning partially about Africa. Why not make that a singular thing or two-parter in terms of classes? You know what I'm saying? You do this one, you do this one. I mean, it's to watch a black or brown kid go to culinary school and go, I didn't learn about native food. I didn't learn about no African food. You know, I barely learned about Latinx food, what that means. And then what it actually is, not just the ingredients, techniques, and blah, 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 recipes, blah, blah.
Right.
You know, more than that.
History.
History. It also means reparations in terms of land.
Mm-hmm.
Land. Stop giving away this damn land to these developers. Give it to folks who want to farm and produce or keep it natural. Just keep it natural. Because another part of our story, it's not just always messing with the earth. It's also engaging with foraging, fishing, hunting, raising livestock. It's, you know, those are things that preserve our culture, as well as just do that. For, to me, reparations looks like all of that, and then more so.
So it's completely taking back the food system.
Yes, and re-Africanizing it.
Re-Africanizing the food system. I like that.
Yeah,
that would sound so scary to so many people. Why shouldn't that be scary?
The first things first. I mean, I want to ask anyone who thinks, I don't know about that, should ask themselves why my last name is Twitty and not Njai.
Mm-hmm.
Should ask themselves why my beard and my hair go out of my face like this and not curly. There's so many aspects of Black identity in America and in the Americas, plural. Because, you know, we're in a shit show in Brazil. We're in a shit show in parts of the Caribbean. Because we're still underneath those colonial and slavery forces. Like, people never even ask themselves, what would it be like to wake up tomorrow and not have the family name that's been passed into my family for hundreds of years? What would it be like if my child did not look like me because of some viciousness?
Right.
What would it be like if I couldn't tell you who I was beyond a certain point because it was taken from me? So if I can live this life for 401 years, you know, your Eurocentric life, you can come with me to the multi-million-year-old African life and understand, oh my God, that's part of who we are. Yes, you know, blackness is not a bubble. You are part of blackness too. The same way I've signed on to be part Italian, part Mexican, part Chinese, part Korean in this multicultural society we have. If you don't understand what a bloody gift it is to be in this global era in a multicultural society, you don't know how to be an American. And it's a shame that those of us who've had the most to lose, African and indigenous people, have to teach that to the rest of everybody.
Right.
Got me preaching.
That's good. And why not? I'll let that sit in. Just sink in here for a second. I want to ask you about, again, I want to go back to your book, The Cooking Gene. Mm-hmm. And there was a quote. I'm a fan of your writing. Obviously, I'm a fan of what you're writing about, but the prose itself, I just find to be so it's so descriptive to the point where when you write about your kitchen, I feel like I'm sitting in your kitchen. When you write about, again, like homecoming, I feel I'm at that table. Mm. When you write about your experience, this is what I love about your writing. I could almost put myself in the experience, although I know that is I can't completely get there, but the writing does that, and that's what good writing usually does. And so, but you wrote in your book, and you were talking about literacy, and you were talking, I think the quote is, we could write down our own stories. We had to tell them to others, and this caused facts and words to be bent. I wonder what our history would have looked like if every man and woman could have written down or passed down a written account of their own lives. Mm-hmm. Is this why you write?
Yeah. Because, you know, there's so many details. It's a lot of times, especially with our food history and our culture, it's like, even among our own people, in America, I mean, everybody buys into the same narrative you can tell in 30 seconds. They were stolen from Africa. They came to America. The white people threw some shit at them, threw some slop at them. They remixed it. They were geniuses, created soul food. And that's all you need to know. They don't know that everybody didn't have collard greens, for example, or that there's like 60 different type of collard greens, and that things were very regional, hyper specific to the climate, the area that you're in, or even the type of enslaved Africans, what ethnic group they came from. So, for example, as an Italian American, there's a big difference between people who came from northern and central Italy to America and those that came from the south. And the languages, the dialects that they brought from Sicily and Naples and Calabria versus other parts of Italy, that, and where they settled and what kind of jobs did they do. All that matters in Black food history and Southern food history, American food history as well. So I'm actually, it's kind of horrible because you get to the point where you realize that you got to leave a legacy and you can't tell everything, but you can leave the blueprint behind, you know. That's what Therese Nelson is actually responsible for the format of this book. But she talked to me one day, she said, we both come from Black folks from South Carolina. We only know so much about where we come from. I want you to write us a blueprint so we can find our way on our own. Yeah, that's my goal, is to make a blueprint.
And that's a blueprint to be used by other people to find their way as well.
Look, when I first started this project, I had a young man. He was a little bit younger than me. We weren't that far apart in age. And I did a speech in a college in Pennsylvania. And he comes up to me and he says, "Hey, Michael, I want you to know that in 2 days, I'm leaving for Italy." And he said, "I saw your journey down south." And he said, "I want to do the same thing with my family." He says, "My family's from Scranton in New York." And he says, "I always loved my grandmother's food and my family and traditions, but I don't really know where they came from. I know what their life was like back in Italy." And he said, "I didn't even think about that till I started following your journey. So I'm getting on a plane in 2 days." I don't know what happened to him. But for me, that was validating in the sense of, I know that my journey is universal. Do white people know that? Do white people know that I'm speaking to them as well? That I am not leaving them out of the conversation? That if they are not in the conversation, I'm not doing this right? And Black folks, yes, I am centering us, but I want you to know something. I'm not rehashing some easy, unnuanced, uncomplicated myth that we can just glide by. No, this is going to make everybody either pissed off, inspired, and in love, or I'm not doing this right.
Is there an American cuisine?
Absolutely.
And what
absolutely. Yeah,
what I mean, obviously we can go through region by region, but what do you think the roots of American cuisine is?
I think it's layers. I think we have to understand things are in layers because they're different. I'm a lover of American history, and especially a lover of African and African American history. But I gotta tell you that it's not one thing. And yes, there's regions and there's all that. That's important. But I guess for me, the roots of the cuisine are indigenous and African. If I had to boil it down to five groups, I would say you have to talk about indigenous people. You have to talk about Africans. You have to talk about, I call it the Iberian world in the Americas. So, yeah, I don't want to call it Latin or Latino. I just want to call it that, you know, when the Spanish and Portuguese came to the Americas and interacted with Native and African people, They came with a food agenda because they were food lovers, and they set up a food environment that approximated what they had. You know, I would say that you can't talk about American cuisine without talking about Italians on their own. And then, you know, with them, the Greeks are the Mediterranean people. And you talk about it without East Asia, you know, because, and I say that because other groups have, of course, built their food culture in America on the roots that were established by these, you know, immigrant communities and indigenous communities. But you know, is I say that, you know, one of the answers I have to appropriation, which we can get into, and cultural sharing, is that if you were from the Pacific Northwest and you grew up with, you know, Pacific Rim food and in the natural food of the Pacific Northwest, those beautiful cherries and wild fruits and all of that, and native ingredients and the fish and all that, that's what you're rooted in. It doesn't matter what color or background you are. That region feeds who you are. You know when somebody's from a place and they love that place because they're rooted in those food traditions. So yeah, I mean, American food is in layers. It's global, it's indigenous, it's colonial. And by colonial, I do not mean nice little colonial buckles on the shoes. I mean colonial as in, oh my God, this is horrific. And it's also divisive. American food by its very nature is divisive. And we have to understand this. It's divisive. You don't hear anybody else more than Americans argue more about the precision of recipes based on state, region, place. And also Americans racialize food more than anybody else. So I think we have to really have to wrestle with that we have a food tradition that's very chauvinistic and divisive, even though it's incredibly beautiful.
And you're right. So you said something really important there, because when people, and I've always thought about this in terms of what I do, I cook what I call American food. It's really it's some influences from Italy and France, because that's kind of how I grew up cooking.
Right.
But, and I would say sometimes, like, people don't say they want to go out for American food. It's like they want to go out for French food or Italian food or maybe Greek food. When they start saying, we want to go out for African food, when white people start saying that, maybe that's when it starts to sink in. You know, maybe that's what we need to start hearing. And obviously it needs to be taught. Listen, we need to start in schools and teach history. I mean, I screwed up royally in naming a restaurant a couple years back. It was in an old historical building. There were two publishers named Fowler and Wells in the building. And they published journals of phrenology. And I had no idea what that meant in terms of, you know, how it affect black people. I had no idea what rabbit hole I was going down. I was never taught. And for me, I was like, you know what? I got to be a little more, take a little more responsibility and do the work, because I stopped short. I thought I did the work, but I stopped short. And so it was just eye-opening to what I was leading into, the idea of teaching history in school. And we're leaving out huge pieces of it.
Yes.
And so, again, going back to what your blueprint, it's a blueprint of really, really anyone to take that journey and find history, but also realizing that there's a huge part of American history that is left off, and it's not enough to have Black History Month.
No, it's not enough. But you know what? You know what? I'm not gonna absolve you of your journey, because your journey in that was important.
I'm not looking for absolution here.
No. I know you're not, because you're taking responsibility. Sure. You're owning it. But I'm gonna say something to you about it, because I think that this cultural literacy problem affects us both. Okay? Because I respect the fact that you have, the person you described who was working for you had a really in-depth sort of like engagement with awareness. But bruh, man, I know a lot of well-educated Negroes that wouldn't know the difference any more than you. Because listen, and this is why people get upset not people, excuse me. Let me be specific. White people who are kind of caught unaware. They get upset because they go, well, I didn't know that. Well, this wasn't this. And that. Why does it matter? Why are you bringing politics in this? Why are you bringing race into it? Whereas those of us who are on this other path are going, if you don't know how insidious and how woven in this is to the basic fabric of not just American, but Western society, period, then yeah, you're missing the point. I mean, to me, it's like to be aware of these things, to be aware of these connections is really to have to confront oneself. You have to, part of the educational process isn't just knowing the facts. It's knowing what the facts mean to you. What do they actually on the ground mean? I mean, I'm collecting American history textbooks right now. And not one of these damn cook textbooks, except for maybe the one that's coming, not one of them talks about how important cotton was to the American economy.
To the European economy, too.
Yes, exactly. And all the fact that there's, like, people think of, I've heard 1,000 times. Yeah, I know that you had a shitty life. You're picking cotton down south or something. But then you got your freedom. No excuses. And I said, no. That cotton represented 2/3 of the American economy. And the processing of that cotton, exportation of that cotton, meant the European immigrants come here to a better life, get land, have opportunities. So no. Tobacco paid for the American Revolution via France. Hmm. We paid our debts. And then when the French and the Germans went into revolution, there was the planters of the Upper South started growing wheat and corn because Europe wasn't even growing grain anymore. It was a constant revolution and a war. So if you don't know those three facts, right, 3 or 4 facts, then you think that the Black experience is ancillary to whiteness. And it's not. It's central.
Right.
No different than me having to understand that when Europeans decimated their resources between the 14th and 17th centuries, they then had to figure out either we're going to do some massive review what we're doing, or we have to go other places and colonize. Right. We have to, you know, the last comment on that. We have to know how interpersonal and interconnected our stories are. You know, there's no way that I can appreciate you without that contextual fullness. And so it has to be more than just places and dates and times and odd trivia. It has to be meaningful and you have to feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I that's what I imagine is so hard for so many people. You know, you look at the original sin of our country, and slavery is that sin, and then have to go back and say, man, not only did we, you know, build our country on the bodies of enslaved people, but they actually made the country. And people don't want to give that up. And I think even liberal people, I think, look at it and go, well, yeah, okay, I get it. And it all sounds good and let's move on. No, I can't move on because unless you actually admit to that, there's no moving on. Right.
Right.
That's where I think the change, when we're talking right now of obviously with George Floyd's death and people, yes, that there's changes in the air, and COVID also exposed so many, the fragility of our country and our economic system and our food system. And so, you know, can we find a better way? But it has to start with actually, you know, acknowledging that. And until we do that, there is no moving forward. And
people don't want to be vulnerable, Tom.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
They don't want to be vulnerable. They don't want to cede power. You know something? I think you said something about that one time. And I said, somebody better take his white card and give him black toaster. Because he just said something about ceding some damn power. Because that's honestly what's up. And it's not that you're giving away all the power. It's just saying, I can afford.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about fame or position or platform. Yeah. You just talking about whiteness. You said, I can afford to see some of this whiteness, and so can you.
It's not going to make me any different. It's not going to change my life. But it could change a lot of other people's lives, you know. And that's where I think the conversation needs to go. I'm hearing from so many of my friends, just sit back and listen, do the work. You don't need to have the answers. Don't even think you have the answers. And I got to say, this conversation, I was nervous coming in. And I feel so much better after having it. And I don't say that from wanting you to make me feel better about myself, but I having voices like you out there, and I really believe that you can heal so much through food, and using food as the context by reclaiming history, telling history, having people understand the experience, having people like you doing it, I think gets us closer to understanding acceptance, you know, changing some minds and changing, you know, our experience here in this country, because something's got to give.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, I just, you know, you're not afraid. I'm just happy to spend this last, I think we're going on an hour now with you. So thanks, man. This was a great conversation.
I appreciate it. The hardest thing I do is when I interpret slavery, sometimes people don't understand. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of times it's fellow people of color, and they think, why are you re-traumatizing us? I'm not re-traumatizing you. Yeah. I'm showing you the way to heal yourself is to stare your past, your present, your future right in the eyes and don't blink. Hug your ancestor and hug your descendant and hug yourself and heal and move. We have to, because you know something, we cook in the kitchen with dead people. The funniest thing I remember from when he did dinner with Omar was I was joking about, you know, when you're white, your people stay dead, and you go, not when you're Italian. So yeah.
Now they have a way of coming.
They
back
show up. You. They show up.
They
I
do.
Know.
They do. They show up. They really do. All right, Michael. Pleasure talking to you. Stay.
Thank you, folks. Thank you, family.
Stay safe, man.
Absolutely, y'all too.
Again, a very special thanks to Chef Michael Twitty, and as always, a shout out to A Place at the Table. Citizen Chef is a production of iHeartMedia. Christopher Hasiotis is our executive producer. Jesslyn Shields is our researcher, and Gabrielle Collins is our producer and editor. Don't forget to rate us, and we'll catch you next episode.